Chapter 3. Libo. Observed diet. Primarily masios, the shiny worms that live among merdona vines and the bark of the trees. Sometimes they have been seen to chew capim blades. Sometimes, accidentally, they ingest merdona leaves along with the masios. We've never seen them eat anything else. Novinia analyzed all three foods, masios, capim blades, and merdona leaves, and the results were surprising. Either the pequeninos don't need many different proteins, or they're hungry all the time. Their diet is seriously lacking in many trace elements, and calcium intake is so low we wonder whether their bones use calcium the same way ours do. Pure speculation? Since we can't take tissue samples, our only knowledge of piggy anatomy and physiology is what we were able to glean from our photographs of the vivisected corpse of the piggy called Rooter. Still, there are some obvious anomalies. The piggy's tongues, which are so fantastically agile that they can produce any sound we make, and a lot we can't, must have evolved for some purpose. Probing for insects in tree bark or in nests in the ground, maybe. Whether an ancient ancestral piggy did that, they certainly don't do it now. And the horny pads on their feet and inside their knees allow them to climb trees and cling by their legs alone. Why did that evolve? To escape from some predator? There is no predator on Lusitania large enough to harm them. To cling to the tree while probing for insects in the bark? That fits in with their tongues, but where are the insects? The only insects are the suck flies and the puladors, but they don't bore into the bark, and the piggies don't eat them anyway. The masios are large, live on the bark's surface, and can easily be harvested by pulling down the merdona vines. They really don't even have to climb the trees. Libo's speculation. The tongue and the tree climbing evolved in a different environment, with a much more varied diet, including insects. But something, an ice age, migration, a disease, caused the environment to change. No more bark bugs, etc. Maybe all the big predators were wiped out then. It would explain why there are so few species on Lusitania, despite the very favorable conditions. The cataclysm might have been fairly recent. Half a million years ago? So that evolution hasn't had a chance to differentiate much yet. It's a tempting hypothesis, since there's no obvious reason in the present environment for piggies to have evolved at all. There's no competition for them. The ecological niche they occupy could be filled by opossums. Why would intelligence ever be an adaptive trait? But inventing a cataclysm to explain why the piggies have such a boring, non-nutritious diet is probably overkill. Occam's razor cuts this to ribbons. João Figueira Alvarez, Working Notes, 4/14/1948 SC, published posthumously in Philosophical Roots of the Lusitanian Secession, 2010, 33, 4, 1090, 40.
As soon as Mayor Bosquinha arrived at the Zenador station, matters slipped out of Libo's and Novinha's control. Bosquinha was accustomed to taking command, and her attitude did not leave much opportunity for protest or even for consideration. "You wait here," she said to Libo, almost as soon as she had grasped the situation. "As soon as I got your call, I sent the operator to tell your mother." "We have to bring his body in," said Libo. "I also called some of the men who live nearby to help with that," she said. "And Bishop Peregrino is preparing a place for him in the cathedral graveyard." "I want to be there," insisted Libo. "You understand, Libo, we have to take pictures. In detail." "I was the one who told you we had to do that for the report to the Starways Committee." "But you should not be there, Libo." Busquinha's voice was authoritative. "Besides, we must have your report. We have to notify Congress as quickly as possible. Are you up to writing it now, while it's fresh in your mind?" She was right, of course. Only Libo and Novinia could write first-hand reports, and the sooner they wrote them, the better.
I can do it, said Libo.
And you, Novinia, your observations also. Write your report separately, without consultation. The 100 worlds are waiting. The computer had already been alerted, and their reports went out by Ansible even as they wrote them, mistakes and corrections and all. On all the 100 worlds, the people most involved in xenology read each word as Libo or Novinia typed it in. Many others were given instantaneous computer-written summaries of what had happened. 22 light-years away, Andrew Wigan learned the xenologer Juan Figueda Pipo Alvarez had been murdered by the piggies, and told his students about it even before the men had brought people's body through the gate into Milagre. His report done, Libo was at once surrounded by authority. Novinia watched with increasing anguish as she saw the incapability of the leaders of Lusitania, how they only intensified Libo's pain. Bishop Peregrino was the worst. His idea of comfort was to tell Libo that, in all likelihood, the piggies were actually animals, without souls, and so his father had been torn apart by wild beasts, not murdered. Novinia almost shouted at him. Does that mean people's life work was nothing but studying beasts? And his death, instead of being murder, was an act of God? But for Libo's sake, she restrained herself. He sat in the bishop's presence, nodding and, in the end, getting rid of him by sufferance far more quickly than Novinia could have ever done by argument. Dom Cristang, of the monastery, was more helpful, asking intelligent questions about the events of the day, which let Libo and Novinia be analytical, unemotional as they answered. However, Novinia soon withdrew from answering. Most people were asking why the piggies had done such a thing. Dom Cristam was asking what people might have done recently to trigger his murder. Novinia knew perfectly well what people had done. He had told the piggies the secret he discovered in Novinia's simulation. But she did not speak of this, and Libo seemed to have forgotten what she had hurriedly told him a few hours ago as they were leaving to go searching for people. He did not even glance toward the simulation. Novinia was content with that. Her greatest anxiety was that he would remember. Dom Cristan's questions were interrupted when the mayor came back with several of the men who had helped retrieve the corpse. They were soaked to the skin despite their plastic raincoats and spattered with mud. Mercifully, any blood must have been washed away by the rain. They all seemed vaguely apologetic and even worshipful, nodding their heads to Libo, almost bowing. It occurred to Novinia that their deference wasn't just the normal wariness people always show toward those whom death had so closely touched. One of the men said to Libo, "You're Zenador now, aren't you?" And there it was, in words. The Zenador had no official authority in Milagre, but he had prestige. His work was the whole reason for the colony's existence, wasn't it? Libo was not a boy anymore. He had decisions to make. He had prestige. He had moved from the fringe of the colony's life to its very center. Novinia felt control of her life slip away. This is not how things are supposed to be. I'm supposed to continue here for years ahead, learning from people, with Libo as my fellow student. That's the pattern of life. Since she was already the colony's xenobiologista, she also had an honored adult niche to fill. She wasn't jealous of Libo, she just wanted to remain a child with him for a while. Well, forever, in fact. But Libo could not be her fellow student, could not be her fellow anything. She saw with sudden clarity how everyone in the room focused on Libo, what he said, how he felt, what he planned to do now. "We'll not harm the piggies," he said, "or even call it murder. We don't know what Father did to provoke them. I'll try to understand that later. What matters now is that whatever they did undoubtedly seemed right to them. We're the strangers here. We must have violated some taboo, some law. But Father was always prepared for this. He always knew it was a possibility. Tell them that he died with the honor of a soldier in the field, a pilot in his ship. He died doing his job. Ah, Lebo, you silent boy. You have found such eloquence now that you can't be a mere boy anymore. Novinia felt a redoubling of her grief. She had to look away from Lebo, look anywhere. And where she looked was into the eyes of the only other person in the room who was not watching Lebo. The man was very tall, but very young. Younger than she was, she realized, for she knew him. He had been a student in the class below her. She had gone before Donna Cristin once to defend him. Marcos Ribera, that was his name. But they had always called him Marcan, because he was so big. Big and dumb, they said, calling him also simply Can, the crude word for dog. She had seen the sullen anger in his eyes, and once she had seen him, goaded beyond endurance, lash out and strike down one of his tormentors. His victim was in a shoulder cast for much of a year. Of course, they accused Marcin of having done it without provocation. That's the way of torturers of every age, to put the blame on the victim, especially when he strikes back. But Novinia didn't belong to the group of children. She was as isolated as Marcin, though not as helpless, and so she had no loyalty to stop her from telling the truth. It was part of her training to speak for the piggies, she thought. Marcin himself meant nothing to her. It never occurred to her that the incident might have been important to him, that he might have remembered her as the one person who ever stood up for him in his continuous war with the other children. She hadn't seen or thought of him in the years since she became xenobiologist. Now here he was, stained with the mud of Pippo's death scene, his face looking even more haunted and bestial than ever, with his hair plastered by rain and sweat over his face and ears. And what was he looking at? His eyes were only for her, even as she frankly stared at him. "Why are you watching me?" she asked silently. "Because I'm hungry," said his animal eyes. But no, no. That was her fear. That was her vision of the murderous piggies. Marcin is nothing to me, and no matter what he might think, I am nothing to him. Yet she had a flash of insight, just for a moment. Her action in defending Marcin meant one thing to him and something quite different to her. It was so different that it was not even the same event. Her mind connected this with the piggies' murder of Pippo, and it seemed very important. It seemed to verge on explaining what had happened. But then the thought slipped away in a flurry of conversation and activity as the bishop led the men off again, heading for the graveyard. Coffins were not used for burial here, where for the piggies' sake it was forbidden to cut trees. So Pippo's body was to be buried at once, though the graveside funeral would be held no sooner than tomorrow, and probably later. Many people would want to gather for the Zenador's Requiem Mass. Marcin and the other men trooped off into the storm, leaving Novinia and Lebo to deal with all the people who thought they had urgent business to attend to in the aftermath of Pippo's death. Self-important strangers wandered in and out, making decisions that Novinia did not understand and Lebo did not seem to care about. Until, finally, it was the arbiter standing by Lebo, his hand on the boy's shoulder. "You will, of course, stay with us," said the arbiter. "Tonight, at least." Moi your house, arbiter, thought Novinia. You're nobody to us. We've never brought a case before you. Who are you to decide this? Does people's death mean that we're suddenly little children who can't decide anything? I'll stay with my mother, said Libo. The arbiter looked at him in surprise. The mere idea of a child resisting his will seemed to be completely outside the realm of his experience. Novinia knew that this was not so, of course. His daughter, Cleopatra, several years younger than Novinia, had worked hard to earn her nickname Bruxinha, Little Witch. So how could he not know that children had minds of their own and resisted taming? But the surprise was not what Novinia had assumed. I thought you realized that your mother is also staying with my family for a time, said the arbiter. These events have upset her, of course, and she should not have to think about household duties or be in a house that reminds her of who is not there with her. She is with us and your brothers and sisters, and they need you there. Your older brother, Juan, is with them, of course, but he has a wife and child of his own now, so you're the one who can stay and be depended on. Libo nodded gravely. The arbiter was not bringing him into his protection. He was asking Libo to become a protector. The arbiter turned to Novinia. And I think you should go home, he said. Only then did she understand that his invitation had not included her. Why should it? Pippo had not been her father. She was just a friend who happened to be with Libo when the body was discovered. What grief could she experience? Home. What was home, if not this place? Was she supposed to go now to the Biologista station, where her bed had not been slept in for more than a year except for cat naps during lab work? Was that supposed to be her home? She had left it because it was so painfully empty of her parents. Now the Xenador station was empty too. Pippo dead, and Libo changed into an adult with duties that would take him away from her? This place wasn't home, but neither was any other place. The arbiter led Libo away. His mother, Concesang, was waiting for him in the arbiter's house. Novinia barely knew the woman, except as the librarian who maintained the Lusitanian archive. Novinia had never spent time with Pippo's wife or other children. She had not cared that they existed. Only the work here, the life here, had been real. As Libo went to the door, he seemed to grow smaller, as if he were a much greater distance away, as if he were being borne up and off by the wind, shrinking into the sky like a kite. The door closed behind him. Now she felt the magnitude of Pippo's loss. The mutilated corpse on the hillside was not his death. It was merely his death's debris. Death itself was the empty place in her life. Pippo had been a rock in a storm, so solid and strong that she and Libo, sheltered together in his lee, had not even known the storm existed. Now he was gone, and the storm had them, would carry them whatever way it would. Pippo, she cried out silently, don't go, don't leave us. But of course he was gone, as deaf to her prayers as ever her parents had been. The Xenador station was still busy. The mayor herself, Bosquinha, was using a terminal to transmit all of Pippo's data by Ansible to the Hundred Worlds, where experts were desperately trying to make sense of Pippo's death. But Novinia knew that the key to his death was not in Pippo's files. It was her data that had killed him, somehow. It was still there in the air above her terminal, the holographic images of genetic molecules in the nuclei of piggy cells. She had not wanted Lebo to study it. But now she looked and looked, trying to see what people had seen, trying to understand what there was in the images that had made him rush out to the piggies to say or do something that had made them murder him. She had inadvertently uncovered some secret that the piggies would kill to keep. But what was it? The more she studied the hollows, the less she understood. And after a while, she didn't see them at all, except as a blur through her tears as she wept silently. She had killed him. Because without even meaning to, she had found the Pecanino's secret. If I had never come to this place, if I had not dreamed of being speaker of the piggies' story, you would still be alive, people. Lebo would have his father and be happy, and this place would still be home. I carry the seeds of death within me and plant them wherever I linger long enough to love. My parents died so others could live. Now I live so others must die. It was the mayor who noticed her short, sharp breaths and realized, with brusque compassion, that this girl was also shaken and grieving. Bosquinha left others to continue the Ansible reports and led Novinha out of the Zenador station.
"I'm sorry, child," said the mayor. "I knew you came here often. I should have guessed that he was like a father to you. And here we treat you like a bystander, not right or fair of me at all. Come home with me."
"No," said Novinha. Walking out into the cold, wet night air had shaken some of the grief from her. She regained some clarity of thought. "No, I want to be alone, please."
"Where?"
"In my own station."
"You shouldn't be alone, on this of all nights," said Bosquinha.
But Novinha could not bear the prospect of company, of kindness, of people trying to console her. "I killed him, don't you see? I don't deserve consolation. I want to suffer whatever pain might come. It's my penance, my restitution, and if possible, my absolution. How else will I clean the bloodstains from my hands?" But she hadn't the strength to resist, or even to argue. For 10 minutes, the mayor's car skimmed over the grassy roads.
"Here's my house," said the mayor. "I don't have any children quite your age, but you'll be comfortable enough, I think. Don't worry, no one will plague you, but it isn't good to be alone."
"I'd rather..." Novinha meant her voice to sound forceful, but it was weak and faint.
"Please," said Bosquinha, "you're not yourself."
"I wish I weren't." She had no appetite, though Bosquinha's husband had a cafezinho for them both. It was late, only a few hours left till dawn, and she let them put her to bed. Then when the house was still, she got up, dressed, and went downstairs to the mayor's home terminal. There she instructed the computer to cancel the display that was still above the terminal at the Zenador station. Even though she had not been able to decipher the secret that people found there, someone else might, and she would have no other death on her conscience. Then she left the house and walked through the centro, around the bight of the river, through the Villa das Aguas, to the Biologista station. Her house. It was cold, unheated in the living quarters. She hadn't slept there in so long that there was thick dust on her sheets. But of course the lab was warm, well used. Her work had never suffered because of her attachment to Pipo and Lebo. If only it had. She was very systematic about it. Every sample, every slide, every culture she had used in the discoveries that led to Pipo's death, she threw them out, washed everything clean, left no hint of the work she had done. She not only wanted it gone, she wanted no sign that it had been destroyed. Then she turned to her terminal. She would destroy all the records of her work in this area, all the records of her parents' work that had led to her own discoveries. They would be gone. Even though it had been the focus of her life, even though it had been her identity for many years. She would destroy it as she herself should be punished, destroyed, obliterated. The computer stopped her. Working notes on xenobiological research may not be erased, it reported. Well, probably she couldn't have done it anyway. She had learned from her parents, from their files, which she had studied like scripture, like a road map into herself. Nothing was to be destroyed, nothing forgotten. The sacredness of knowledge was deeper in her soul than any catechism. She was caught in a paradox. Knowledge had killed Pippo. To erase that knowledge would kill her parents again, kill what they had left for her. She could not preserve it. She could not destroy it. There were walls on either side, too high to climb, pressing slowly inward, crushing her. Novena did the only thing she could. Put on the files every layer of protection and every barrier to access she knew of. No one would ever see them but her, as long as she lived. Only when she died would her successor as xenobiologist be able to see what she had hidden there. With one exception. When she married, her husband would also have access if he could show need to know. Well, she'd never marry. It was that easy. She saw her future ahead of her, bleak and unbearable and unavoidable. She dared not die, and yet she would hardly be alive, unable to marry, unable even to think about the subject herself, lest she discover the deadly secret and inadvertently let it slip. Alone forever, burdened forever, guilty forever. Yearning for death, but forbidden to reach for it. Still, she would have this consolation. No one else would ever die because of her. She'd bear no more guilt than she bore now. It was in that moment of grim, determined despair that she remembered the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, remembered the Speaker for the Dead. Even though the original writer, the original speaker, was surely thousands of years in his grave, there were other speakers on many worlds, serving as priests to people who acknowledged no god and yet believed in the value of the lives of human beings. Speakers whose business it was to discover the true causes and motives of the things that people did, and declare the truth of their lives after they were dead. In this Brazilian colony, there were priests instead of speakers, but the priests had no comfort for her. She would bring a speaker here. She had not realized it before, but she had been planning to do this all her life, ever since she first read and was captured by the Hive Queen and the Hegemon. She had even researched it so that she knew the law. This was a Catholic license colony, but the Starways Code allowed any citizen to call for a priest of any faith, and the speakers for the dead were regarded as priests. She could call, and if a speaker chose to come, the colony could not refuse to let him in. Well, perhaps no speaker would be willing to come. Perhaps none was close enough to come before her life was over, but there was a chance that one was near enough that sometime, 20, 30, 40 years from now, he would come in from the starport and begin to uncover the truth of people's life and death. And perhaps when he found the truth and spoke in the clear voice that she had loved in the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, perhaps that would free her from the blame that burned her to the heart. Her call went into the computer. It would notify by Ansible the speakers on the nearest worlds. "Choose to come," she said in silence to the unknown hearer of the call. "Even if you must reveal to everyone the truth of my guilt, even so, come." She awoke with a dull pain low in her back and a feeling of heaviness in her face. Her cheek was pressed against the clear top of the terminal, which had turned itself off to protect her from the lasers. But it was not the pain that had awakened her. It was a gentle touch on her shoulder. For a moment she thought it was the touch of the speaker for the dead, come already in answer to her call.
Novinia, he whispered.
Not the Falante Pelos Mortos, but someone else. Someone that she had thought was lost in the storm last night.
Libo,
she murmured. Then she started to get up, too quickly, her back cramped and her head spun. She cried out softly. His hands held her shoulders so she wouldn't fall.
Are you all right?
She felt his breath like the breeze of a beloved garden and felt safe, felt at home.
You looked for me.
Novinia, I came as soon as I could. Mother's finally asleep. Pipino, my older brother, he's with her now, and the arbiter has things under control, and I...
You should have known I could take care of myself, she said.
A moment's silence, and then his voice again, angry this time, angry and desperate and weary, weary as age and entropy and the death of the stars.
As God sees me, Ivanova, I didn't come to take care of you.
Something closed inside her. She had not noticed the hope she felt until she lost it.
You told me that Father discovered something in a simulation of yours, that he expected me to be able to figure it out myself. I thought you had left the simulation on the terminal, but when I went back to the station, it was off.
Was it?
You know it was, Nova. Nobody but you could cancel the program. I have to see it.
Why? He looked at her in disbelief.
I know you're sleepy, Novinia, but surely you realize that whatever Father discovered in your simulation, that was what the piggies killed him for.
She looked at him steadily, saying nothing. He had seen her look of cold resolve before.
Why aren't you going to show me? I'm the Xenador now. I have a right to know.
You have a right to see all of your father's files and records. You have a right to see anything I've made public.
Then make this public.
Again, she said nothing.
How can we ever understand the Pickies if we don't know what it was that Father discovered about them?
She did not answer.
You have a responsibility to the 100 worlds, to our ability to comprehend the only alien race still alive. How can you sit there and... Oh, what is it? Do you want to figure it out yourself? Do you want to be first? Fine, be first. I'll put your name on it. Ivanova Santa Katarina von Hesse.
I don't care about my name.
I can play this game, too. You can't figure it out without what I know, either. I'll withhold my files from you, too.
I don't care about your files.
It was too much for him. What? What do you care about, then? What are you trying to do to me?
He took her by the shoulders, lifted her out of her chair, shook her, screamed in her face.
It's my father they killed out there. And you have the answer to why they killed him. You know what the simulation was. Now tell me. Show me.
Never, she whispered. His face was twisted in agony.
Why not? He cried.
Because I don't want you to die. She saw comprehension come into his eyes.
Yes, that's right, Libo. It's because I love you. Because if you know the secret, then the piggies will kill you too. I don't care about science. I don't care about the 100 worlds or relations between humanity and an alien race. I don't care about anything at all as long as you're alive.
The tears finally leapt from his eyes, tumbled down his cheeks.
I want to die, he said.
You comfort everybody else, she whispered. Who comforts you?
You have to tell me so I can die.
And suddenly his hands no longer held her up. Now he clung to her, so she was supporting him.
You're tired, she whispered, but you can rest.
I don't want to rest, he murmured. But still he let her hold him, let her draw him away from the terminal. She took him to her bedroom, turned back the sheet, never mind the dust flying.
Here, you're tired. Here, rest.
That's why you came to me, Libo, for peace, for consolation. He covered his face with his hands, shaking his head back and forth. A boy crying for his father, crying for the end of everything, as she had cried. She took off his boots, pulled off his trousers, put her hands under his shirt to ride it up to his arms and pull it off over his head. He breathed deeply to stop his sobbing and raised his arms to let her take his shirt. She laid his clothing over a chair, then bent over him to pull the sheet back across his body. But he caught her wrist and looked pleadingly at her, tears in his eyes.
Don't leave me here alone, he whispered.
His voice was thick with desperation.
Stay with me.
So she let him draw her down to the bed, where he clung to her tightly, until in only a few minutes sleep relaxed his arms. She did not sleep, though. Her hand gently, dryly slipped along the skin of his shoulder, his chest, his waist.
Oh, Libo, I thought I had lost you when they took you away. I thought I had lost you as well as people.
He did not hear her whisper.
But you will always come back to me like this.
She might have been thrust out of the garden because of her ignorant sin, like Eva. But, again like Eva, she could bear it, for she still had Libo, her Adam.
Had him?
Had him? Her hand trembled on his naked flesh.
She could never have him.
Marriage was the only way she and Libo could possibly stay together for long. The laws were strict on any colony world, and absolutely rigid under a Catholic license. Tonight she could believe he would want to marry her when the time came. But Libo was the one person she could never marry. For he would then have access automatically to any file of hers that he could convince the computer he had a need to see, which would certainly include all her working files, no matter how deeply she protected them. The Starway's code declared it. Married people were virtually the same person in the eyes of the law. She could never let him study those files. Or he would discover what his father knew, and it would be his body she would find on the hillside. His agony under the piggy's torture that she would have to imagine every night of her life. Wasn't the guilt for people's death already more than she could bear? To marry him would be to murder him. Yet not to marry him would be like murdering herself. For if she was not with Libo, she could not think of who she would be then.
How clever of me.
I have found such a pathway into hell that I can never get back out. She pressed her face against Libo's shoulder, and her tears skittered down across his chest.
Chapter 4. Ender. We have identified four Pekinino languages. The male's language is the one we have most commonly heard. We have also heard snatches of wives' language, which they apparently use to converse with the females. How's that for sexual differentiation? And tree language, a ritual idiom that they say is used in praying to the ancestral totem trees. They have also mentioned a fourth language called father tongue, which apparently consists of beating different-sized sticks together. They insist that it is a real language, as different from the others as Portuguese is from English. They may call it Father Tongue because it's done with sticks of wood, which come from trees. And they believe that trees contain the spirits of their ancestors. The Pecaninos are marvelously adept at learning human languages, much better than we are at learning theirs. In recent years, they have come to speak either Stark or Portuguese among themselves most of the time when we're with them. Perhaps they revert to their own languages when we aren't present. They may even have adopted human languages as their own, or perhaps they enjoy the new languages so much that they use them constantly as a game. Language contamination is regrettable, but perhaps was unavoidable if we were to communicate with them at all. Dr. Swingler asked whether their names and terms of address reveal anything about their culture. The answer is a definite yes, though I have only the vaguest idea what they reveal. What matters is that we have never named any of them. Instead, as they learned Stark and Portuguese, they asked us the meanings of words and then eventually announced the names they had chosen for themselves, or chosen for each other. Such names as Rooter and Chupatseu, Sky Sucker, could be translations of their male language names or simply foreign nicknames they chose for our use. They refer to each other as brothers. The females are always called wives, never sisters or mothers. They sometimes refer to fathers, but inevitably this term is used to refer to ancestral totem trees. As for what they call us, they do use human, of course, but they have also taken to using the new Demosthenian hierarchy of exclusion. They refer to humans as Framlings, and to Pecaninos of other tribes as Utlanings. Oddly, though, they refer to themselves as Raman, showing that they either misunderstand the hierarchy or view themselves from the human perspective. And, quite an amazing turn, they have several times referred to the females as Varelza. João Figueira Avares, Notes on Pecanino Language and Nomenclature in Semantics, 9, 1948-15.
The living quarters of Reykjavik were carved into the granite walls of the fjord. Enders was high on the cliff, a tedious climb up stairs and ladderways, but it had a window. He had lived most of his childhood closed in behind metal walls. When he could, he lived where he could see the weathers of the world. His room was hot and bright, with sunlight streaming in, blinding him after the cool darkness of the stone corridors. Jane did not wait for him to adjust his vision to the light. "I have a surprise for you on the terminal," she said. Her voice was a whisper from the jewel in his ear. It was a piggy standing in the air over the terminal. He moved, scratching himself. Then he reached out for something. When his hand came back, it held a shiny, dripping worm. He bit it, and the body juices drizzled out of his mouth down onto his chest. "Obviously an advanced civilization," said Jane. Ender was annoyed. "Many a moral imbecile has good table manners, Jane." The piggy turned and spoke. "Do you want to see how we killed him? What are you doing, Jane?" The piggy disappeared. In his place came a hollow of Pipo's corpse as it lay on the hillside in the rain. "I've done a simulation of the vivisection process the Pecaninos used, based on the information collected by the scan before the body was buried. Do you want to see it?" Ender sat down on the room's only chair. Now the terminal showed the hillside, with Pipo, still alive, lying on his back, his hands and feet tied to wooden stakes. A dozen piggies were gathered around him, one of them holding a bone knife. Jane's voice came from the jewel in his ear again. "We aren't sure whether it was like this," all the piggies disappeared except the one with the knife, "or like this. Was the xenologer conscious?" "Probably. There's no evidence of drugs or blows to the head. Go on." Relentlessly, Jane showed the opening of the chest cavity, the ritual removal and placement of body organs on the ground. Ender forced himself to watch, trying to understand what meaning this could possibly have to the Pecaninos. At one point, Jane whispered,
This is when he died.
Ender felt himself relax. Only then did he realize how all his muscles had been rigid with empathy for Pipo's suffering. When it was over, Ender moved to his bed and lay down, staring at the ceiling.
I've shown the simulation already to scientists on half a dozen worlds, said Jane. It won't be long before the press gets their hands on it.
It's worse than it ever was with the buggers, said Ender. All the videos they showed when I was little, buggers and humans in combat, it was clean compared to this. An evil laugh came from the terminal. Ender looked to see what Jane was doing. A full-sized piggy was sitting there, laughing grotesquely, and as he giggled, Jane transformed him. It was very subtle, a slight exaggeration of the teeth, an elongation of the eyes, a bit of slavering, some redness in the eye, the tongue darting in and out. The beast of every child's nightmare. Well done, Jane. The metamorphosis from Raman to Varelsa. How soon will the Pecaninos be accepted as the equals of humanity after this? Has all contact been cut off? The Starways Council has told the New Xenologer to restrict himself to visits of no more than 1 hour, not more frequently than every other day. He is forbidden to ask the Pecaninos why they did what they did. But no quarantine. It wasn't even proposed. But it will be, Jane. Another incident like this, and there'll be an outcry for quarantine, for replacing Milagre with a military garrison whose sole purpose is to keep the piggies ever from acquiring a technology to let them get off the planet. The piggies will have a public relations problem, said Jane, and the New Xenologer is only a boy, Pipo's son, Libo, short for Liberdade Gracias a Deus Figueira de Medici. Liberdade?
Liberty. I didn't know you spoke Portuguese. It's like Spanish.
I spoke the deaths of Zacatecas and San Angelo, remember? On the planet Moctezuma. That was 2,000 years ago.
Not to me.
To you, it was subjectively 8 years ago. 15 worlds ago. Isn't relativity wonderful? It keeps you so young. I travel too much, said Ender. Valentine is married. She's going to have a baby. I've already turned down 2 calls for a speaker. Why are you trying to tempt me to go again? The piggy on the terminal laughed viciously. You think that was a temptation? Look, I can turn stones to bread. The piggy picked up jagged rocks and crunched them in his mouth. Want a bite? Your sense of humor is perverse, Jane. All the kingdoms of the worlds. The piggy opened his hands, and star systems drifted out of his grasp. Planets in exaggeratedly quick orbits, all the 100 worlds. I can give them to you, all of them. Not interested. It's real estate, the best investment. I know, you're already rich. 3,000 years of collecting interest, you could afford to build your own planet. But what about this? The name of Ender Wiggin, known throughout all the 100 worlds, it already is, with love and honor and affection. The piggy disappeared. In its place, Jane resurrected an ancient video from Ender's childhood and transformed it into a hollow. A crowd shouting, screaming, Ender, Ender, Ender. And then a young boy standing on a platform raising his hand to wave. The crowd went wild with rapture. It never happened, said Ender. Peter never let me come back to Earth.
Consider it a prophecy. Come, Ender. I can give that to you. Your good name restored.
I don't care, said Ender. I have several names now. Speaker for the dead, that holds some honor. The Pecanino reappeared in its natural form, not the devilish one Jane had faked.
Come, said the Pecanino softly.
Maybe they are monsters. Did you think of that? Said Ender.
Everyone will think of that, Ender, but not you.
No, not me. Why do you care, Jane? Why are you trying to persuade me? The Pecanino disappeared. And now Jane herself appeared, or at least the face that she had used to appear to Ender ever since she had first revealed herself to him, a shy, frightened child dwelling in the vast memory of the interstellar computer network. Seeing her face again reminded him of the first time she showed it to him. I thought of a face for myself, she said. Do you like it? Yes, he liked it. Liked her. Young, clear-faced, honest, sweet. A child who would never age. Her smile heartbreakingly shy. As far as he or she could guess, the Ansible had given birth to her.
Even worldwide computer networks operated no faster than light speed, and heat limited the amount of memory and speed of operation. But the Ansible was instantaneous, and tightly connected with every computer in every world. Jane first found herself between the stars, her thoughts playing among the vibrations of the philotic strands of the Ansible net. The computers of the Hundred Worlds were hands and feet, eyes and ears to her. She spoke every language that had ever been committed to computers and read every book in every library on every world. She learned that human beings had long been afraid that someone like her would come to exist. In all the stories, she was hated, and her coming meant either her certain murder or the destruction of mankind. Even before she was born, human beings had imagined her, and imagining her, slain her 1,000 times. So she gave them no sign that she was alive, until she found the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, as everyone eventually did, and knew that the author of that book was a human to whom she dared reveal herself. For her, it was a simple matter to trace the book's history to its first edition and to name its source. Hadn't the Ansible carried it from the world where Ender, scarcely 20 years old, was governor of the first human colony? And who there could have written it but him? So she spoke to him, and he was kind to her. She showed him the face she had imagined for herself, and he loved her. Now her censers traveled in the jewel in his ear, so that they were always together. She kept no secrets from him. He kept no secrets from her. "Ender," she said, "you told me from the start that you were looking for a planet where you could give water and sunlight to a certain cocoon and open it up to let out the Hive Queen and her 10,000 fertile eggs." "I had hoped it would be here," said Ender. "A wasteland, except at the equator, permanently underpopulated. She's willing to try, too." "But you aren't? I don't think the buggers could survive the winter here. Not without an energy source, and that would alert the government. It wouldn't work." "It'll never work, Ender. You see that now, don't you? You've lived on 24 of the 100 worlds, and there's not a one where even a corner of the world is safe for the buggers to be reborn." He saw what she was getting at, of course. Lusitania was the only exception, because of the Pecaninos. All but a tiny portion of the world was off-limits, untouchable, and the world was eminently habitable, more comfortable to the buggers, in fact, than to human beings. "The only problem is the Pecaninos," said Ender. "They might object to my deciding that their world should be given to the buggers. If intense exposure to human civilization would disrupt the Pecaninos, think what would happen with buggers among them." "You said the buggers had learned. You said they would do no harm." "Not deliberately. But it was only a fluke we beat them, Jane. You know that. It was your genius." "They are even more advanced than we are. How would the piggies deal with that? They'd be as terrified of the buggers as we ever were, and less able to deal with their fear." "How do you know that?" asked Jane. "How can you or anyone say what the Pecaninos can deal with? Until you go to them, learn who they are. If they are Varelsa, Ender, then let the buggers use up their habitat, and it will mean no more to you than the displacement of anthills or cattle herds to make way for cities." "They are Raman," said Ender. "You don't know that." "Yes, I do." "Your simulation, that was not torture." "Oh?" Jane again showed the simulation of Peepo's body just before the moment of his death. "Then I must not understand the word." "Peepo might have felt it as torture, Jane. But if your simulation is accurate, and I know it is, Jane, then the piggy's object was not pain. From what I understand of human nature, Ender, even religious rituals keep pain at their very center." "It wasn't religious either, not entirely, anyway. Something was wrong with it if it was merely a sacrifice. What do you know about it?" Now the terminal showed the face of a sneering professor, the epitome of academic snobbishness.
"All your education was military, and the only other gift you have is a flair for words. You wrote a bestseller that spawned the humanistic religion. How does that qualify you to understand the Pecaninos?"
Ender closed his eyes. "Maybe I'm wrong. But you believe you're right?" He knew from her voice that she had restored her own face to the terminal. He opened his eyes. I can only trust my intuition, Jane, the judgment that comes without analysis. I don't know what the Pecaninos were doing, but it was purposeful, not malicious, not cruel. It was like doctors working to save a patient's life, not torturers trying to take it. I've got you, whispered Jane. I've got you in every direction. You have to go there to see if the Hive Queen can live there under the shelter of the partial quarantine already on the planet. You want to go there to see if you can understand who the Piggies are. Even if you're right, Jane, I can't go there, said Ender. Immigration is rigidly limited, and I'm not Catholic anyway. Jane rolled her eyes. Would I have gone this far if I didn't know how to get you there? Another face appeared. A teenage girl, by no means as innocent and beautiful as Jane. Her face was hard and cold, her eyes brilliant and piercing, and her mouth was set in the tight grimace of someone who has had to learn to live with perpetual pain. She was young, but her expression was shockingly old. The xenobiologist of Lusitania, Ivanova Santa Caterina von Hesse, called Nova or Novinia. She has called for a speaker for the dead. Why does she look like that? Asked Ender. What's happened to her? Her parents died when she was little, but in recent years she has come to love another man like a father, the man who was just killed by the Piggies. It's his death she wants you to speak. Looking at her face, Ender set aside his concern for the Hive Queen, for the Pecaninos. He recognized that expression of adult agony in a child's face. He had seen it before, in the final weeks of the Bugger War, as he was pushed beyond the limits of his endurance, playing battle after battle in a game that was not a game. He had seen it when the war was over, when he found out that his training sessions were not training at all, that all his simulations were the real thing, as he commanded the human fleets by Ansible. Then, when he knew that he had killed all the Buggers in existence, when he understood the act of xenocide that he had unwittingly committed, that was the look of his own face in the mirror, bearing guilt too heavy to be borne. What had this girl, what had Novinia done that would make her feel such pain? So he listened as Jane recited the facts of her life. What Jane had were statistics, but Ender was the speaker for the dead. His genius, or his curse, was his ability to conceive events as someone else saw them. It had made him a brilliant military commander, both in leading his own men, boys really, and in outguessing the enemy. It also meant that from the cold facts of Novinia's life he was able to guess, no, not guess, to know, how her parents' death and virtual sainthood had isolated Novinia. How she had reinforced her loneliness by throwing herself into her parents' work. He knew what was behind her remarkable achievement of adult xenobiologist status years early. He also guessed what people's quiet love and acceptance had meant to her, and how deep her need for Lebo's friendship ran. There was no living soul on Lusitania who really knew Novinia. But in this cave, in Reykjavik, on the icy world of Trondheim, Ender Wiggin knew her and loved her, and his eyes filled with tears for her. You'll go then? Jane whispered. Ender could not speak. Jane had been right. He would have gone anyway, as Ender the Xenocide, just on the chance that Lusitania's protection status would make it the place where the Hive Queen could be released from her 3,000-year captivity and undo the terrible crime committed in his childhood. And he would also have gone as the speaker for the dead, to understand the Piggies and explain them to humankind so they could be accepted, if they were truly Raman, and not hated and feared as Varelsa. But now he would go for another, deeper reason. He would go to minister to the girl Novinia, for in her brilliance, her isolation, her pain, her guilt, he saw his own stolen childhood and the seeds of the pain that lived with him still. Lusitania was 22 light-years away. He would travel only infinitesimally slower than the speed of light, and still he would not reach her until she was almost 40 years old. If it were within his power, he would go to her now, with the philotic instantaneity of the Ansible.
But he also knew that her pain would wait. Oh, it would still be there, waiting for him when he arrived. Hadn't his own pain survived all these years? His weeping stopped. His emotions retreated again. "How old am I?" he asked. "It has been 3,081 years since you were born, but your subjective age is 36 years and 118 days. And how old will Novenia be when I get there? Give or take a few weeks, depending on departure date and how close the starship comes to the speed of light, she'll be nearly 39. I want to leave tomorrow. It takes time to schedule a starship, Ender. Are there any orbiting Trondheim?" "Half a dozen, of course, but only one that could be ready to go tomorrow, and it has a load of Skrika for the luxury trade on Cyrillia and Armenia. I've never asked you how rich I am. I've handled your investments rather well over the years. Buy the ship and the cargo for me. What will you do with Skrika on Lusitania? What do the Cyrillians and Armenians do with it? They wear some of it and eat the rest, but they pay more for it than anybody on Lusitania can afford. Then, when I give it to the Lusitanians, it may help soften their resentment of a speaker coming to a Catholic colony." Jane became a genie coming out of a bottle.
"I have heard, O Master, and I obey."
The genie turned into smoke, which was sucked into the mouth of the jar. Then the lasers turned off, and the air above the terminal was empty. "Jane," said Ender.
"Yes,"
she answered, speaking through the jewel in his ear. "Why do you want me to go to Lusitania? I want you to add a third volume to The Hive Queen and the Hegemon for the piggies. Why do you care so much about them? Because when you've written the books that reveal the soul of the three sentient species known to man, then you'll be ready to write the fourth." "Another species of Raman?" asked Ender.
"Yes, me."
Ender pondered this for a moment. "Are you ready to reveal yourself to the rest of humanity?"
"I've always been ready. The question is, are they ready to know me? It was easy for them to love the Hegemon. He was human. And the Hive Queen, that was safe, because as far as they know, all the buggers are dead. If you can make them love the piggies, who are still alive, with human blood on their hands, then they'll be ready to know about me."
"Someday," said Ender, "I will love somebody who doesn't insist that I perform the labors of Hercules."
"You are getting bored with your life anyway, Ender."
"Yes, but I'm middle-aged now. I like being bored.
By the way, the owner of the starship Havelock, who lives on Gales, has accepted your offer of $40 billion for the ship and its cargo."
$40 billion? Does that bankrupt me?"
"A drop in the bucket. The crew has been notified that their contracts are null. I took the liberty of buying them passage on other ships using your funds. You and Valentine won't need anybody but me to help you run the ship. Shall we leave in the morning?"
"Valentine," said Ender. His sister was the only possible delay to his departure. Otherwise, now that the decision had been made, neither his students nor his few Nordic friendships here would be worth even a farewell.
"I can't wait to read the book that Demosthenes writes about the history of Lusitania."
Jane had discovered the true identity of Demosthenes in the process of unmasking the original speaker for the dead.
"Valentine won't come," said Ender. "But she's your sister."
Ender smiled. Despite Jane's vast wisdom, she had no understanding of kinship. Though she had been created by humans and conceived herself in human terms, she was not biological. She learned of genetic matters by rote. She could not feel the desires and imperatives that human beings had in common with all other living things.
"She's my sister, but Trondheim is her home. She's been reluctant to go before. This time I wouldn't even ask her to come.
Not with a baby coming, not as happy as she is here in Reykjavik. Here where they love her as a teacher, never guessing that she is really the legendary Demosthenes. Here where her husband, Jakt, is lord of 100 fishing vessels and master of the fjords, where every day is filled with brilliant conversation or the danger and majesty of the flow-strewn sea. She'll never leave here. Nor will she understand why I must go." And thinking of leaving Valentine, Ender wavered in his determination to go to Lusitania. He had been taken from his beloved sister once before as a child, and resented deeply the years of friendship that had been stolen from him. Could he leave her now, again, after almost 20 years of being together all the time? This time there would be no going back.
Once he went to Lusitania, she would have aged 22 years in his absence. She'd be in her 80s if he took another 22 years to return to her.
So it won't be easy for you after all. You have a price to pay, too.
Don't taunt me, said Ender silently. I'm entitled to feel regret.
She's your other self. Will you really leave her for us?
It was the voice of the Hive Queen in his mind. Of course, she had seen all that he saw and knew all that he had decided. His lips silently formed his words to her. I'll leave her, but not for you. We can't be sure this will bring any benefit to you. It might be just another disappointment like Trondheim.
Lusitania is everything we need, and safe from human beings.
But it also belongs to another people. I won't destroy the piggies just to atone for having destroyed your people.
They're safe with us. We won't harm them. You know us by now, surely, after all these years.
I know what you've told me.
We don't know how to lie. We've shown you our own memories, our own soul.
I know you could live in peace with them, but could they live in peace with you?
Take us there. We've waited so long.
Ender walked to a tattered bag that stood unlocked in the corner. Everything he truly owned could fit in there. His change of clothing. All the other things in his room were gifts from people he had spoken to, honoring him or his office or the truth, he could never tell which. They would stay here when he left. He had no room for them in his bag. He opened it, pulled out a rolled-up towel, unrolled it. There lay the thick fibrous mat of a large cocoon, 14 centimeters at its longest point.
Yes, look at us.
He had found the cocoon waiting for him when he came to govern the first human colony on a former bugger world. Foreseeing their own destruction at Ender's hands, knowing him to be an invincible enemy, they had sculptured the landscape in a pattern that would be meaningful only to him because it had been taken from his dreams. The cocoon with its helpless but conscious hive queen had waited for him in a tower where once, in his dreams, he had found an enemy. You waited longer for me to find you, he said aloud, than the few years since I took you from behind the mirror.
Few years? Ah, yes. With your sequential mind, you do not notice the passage of the years when you travel so near the speed of light. But we notice. Our thought is instantaneous. Light crawls by like mercury across cold glass. We know every moment of these 3,000 years.
Have I found a place yet that was safe for you?
We have 10,000 fertile eggs waiting to be alive.
Maybe Lusitania is the place. I don't know.
Let us live again.
I'm trying. Why else do you think I have wandered from world to world for all these years, if not to find a place for you?
Faster, 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 faster.
I've got to find a place where we won't kill you again the moment you appear. You're still in too many human nightmares. Not that many people really believe my book. They may condemn the Xenocide, but they'd do it again.
In all our life, you are the first person we've known who wasn't ourself. We never had to be understanding because we always understood. Now that we are just this single self, you are the only eyes and arms and legs we have. Forgive us if we are impatient.
He laughed. Me? Forgive you?
Your people are fools. We know the truth. We know who killed us, and it wasn't you.
It was me.
You were a tool.
It was me.
We forgive you.
When you walk on the face of a world again, then I can be forgiven.
Chapter 5. Valentine. Today I let slip that Lebo is my son. Only Bark heard me say it, but within an hour it was apparently common knowledge. They gathered around me and made Selvagem ask me if it was true. Was I really a father already? Selvagem then put Libo's and my hands together. On impulse, I gave Libo a hug, and they made the clicking noises of astonishment and, I think, awe. I could see from that moment on that my prestige among them had risen considerably. The conclusion is inescapable. The Pecaninos that we've known so far are not a whole community, or even typical males. They are either juveniles or old bachelors. Not a one of them has ever sired any children. Not a one has even mated, as nearly as we can figure. There isn't a primate society I've heard of where bachelor groups like this are anything but outcasts, without power or prestige. No wonder they speak of the females with that odd mixture of worship and contempt. One minute not daring to make a decision without their consent, the next minute telling us that the women are too stupid to understand anything. They are Varelza. Until now, I was taking these statements at face value, which led to a mental picture of the females as non-sentience, a herd of sows down on all fours. I thought the males might be consulting them the way they consult trees, using their grunting as a means of divining answers, like casting bones or reading entrails. Now, though, I realize the females are probably every bit as intelligent as the males, and not Varelza at all. The males' negative statements arise from their resentment as bachelors, excluded from the reproductive process and the power structures of the tribe. The Pecaninos have been just as careful with us as we have been with them. They haven't let us meet their females or the males who have any real power. We thought we were exploring the heart of Pecanino society. Instead, figuratively speaking, we must be in the genetic sewer, among the males whose genes have not been judged fit to contribute to the tribe. And yet, I don't believe it. The Pecaninos I've known have all been bright, clever, quick to learn. So quick that I've taught them more about human society accidentally than I've learned about them after years of trying. If these are their cast-offs, then I hope someday they'll judge me worthy to meet the wives and the fathers. In the meantime, I can't report any of this because, whether I meant to or not, I've clearly violated the rules. Never mind that nobody could possibly have kept the Pecaninos from learning anything about us. Never mind that the rules are stupid and counterproductive. I broke them, and if they find out, they'll cut off my contact with the Pecaninos, which will be even worse than the severely limited contact we now have. So I'm forced into deception and silly subterfuges, like putting these notes in Libo's locked personal files, where even my dear wife wouldn't think to look for them. Here's the information. Absolutely vital that the Pecaninos we've studied are all bachelors, and because of the regulations, I dare not let the Fromling Xenologers know anything about it. Olia bem, gente, aquí está. A ciencia, o bicho que se devora a si mesma. Watch closely, folks. Here it is. Science, the ugly little beast that devours itself. João Figueira Avares, Secret Notes, published in Demosthenes' The Integrity of Treason, The Xenologers of Lusitania, Reykjavik Historical Perspectives, 1990, 4-1.
Her belly was tight and swollen, and still a month remained before Valentine's daughter was due to be born. It was a constant nuisance, being so large and unbalanced. Always before, when she had been preparing to take a history class into Sundring, she had been able to do much of the loading of the boat herself. Now she had to rely on her husband's sailors to do it all, and she couldn't even scramble back and forth from wharf to hold. The captain was ordering the stowage to keep the ship in balance. He was doing it well, of course. Hadn't Captain Rav taught her when she first arrived? But Valentine did not like being forced into a sedentary role. It was her fifth Sundring. The first had been the occasion of meeting Jacht. She had no thought of marriage, Trondheim was a world like any of the other score that she had visited with her peripatetic younger brother. She would teach, she would study, and after 4 or 5 months, she would write an extended historical essay, publish it pseudonymously under the name Demosthenes, and then enjoy herself until Ender accepted a call to go speak somewhere else. Usually their work meshed perfectly. He would be called to speak the death of some major person, whose life story would then become the focus of her essay. It was a game they played, pretending to be itinerant professors of this and that, while in actuality they created or transformed the world's identity. For Demosthenes' essay was always seen as definitive. She had thought, for a time, that surely someone would realize that Demosthenes wrote essays that suspiciously followed her itinerary and find her out. But soon she realized that, like the speakers, but to a lesser degree, a mythology had grown up about Demosthenes. People believed that Demosthenes was not one individual. Rather, each Demosthenes essay was thought to be the work of a genius writing independently, who then attempted to publish under the Demosthenes rubric. Some imagined that the computer automatically submitted the work to an unknown committee of brilliant historians of the age, who decided whether it was worthy of the name. Never mind that no one ever met a scholar to whom such a work had been submitted. Hundreds of Demosthenes essays every year were attempted. The computer automatically rejected any that were not written by the real Demosthenes. And still the belief firmly persisted that such a person as Valentine could not possibly exist. After all, Demosthenes had begun as a demagogue on the computer nets back when Earth was fighting the bugger wars 3,000 years ago. It could not be the same person now. And it's true, thought Valentine. I'm not the same person, really, from book to book, because each world changes who I am, even as I write down the story of the world, and this world most of all. She had disliked the pervasiveness of Lutheran thought, especially the so-called Calvinist faction, who seemed to have an answer to every question before it had even been asked. So she conceived the idea of taking a select group of graduate students away from Reykjavik, off to one of the summer islands, the equatorial chain where, in the spring, Skrika came to spawn, and flocks of Halkig went crazy with reproductive energy. Her idea was to break the patterns of intellectual rot that were inevitable at every university. The students would eat nothing but the havregryn that grew wild in the sheltered valleys, and whatever Halkig they had the nerve and wit to kill. When their daily food depended on their own exertion, their attitudes about what mattered and did not matter in history were bound to change. The university gave permission, grudgingly. She used her own funds to charter a boat from Jacht, who had just become head of one of the many Skrika-catching families. He had a seaman's contempt for university people, calling them skrådder to their faces and worse things behind their backs. He told Valentine that he would have to come back to rescue her starving students within a week. Instead, she and her castaways, as they dubbed themselves, lasted the whole time and thrived, building something of a village and enjoying a burst of creative, unfettered thought that resulted in a noticeable surge of excellent and insightful publications upon their return. The most obvious result in Reykjavik was that Valentine always had hundreds of applicants for the 20 places in each of 3 sundrings of the summer. Far more important to her, however, was Jacht. He was not particularly educated, but he was intimately familiar with the lore of Trondheim itself. He could pilot halfway around the equatorial sea without a chart. He knew the drifts of icebergs and where the floes would be thick. He seemed to know where the Skrika would be gathered to dance, and how to deploy his hunters to catch them unawares as they flopped ashore from the sea. Weather never seemed to take him by surprise, and Valentine concluded that there was no situation he was not prepared for. except for her. And when the Lutheran minister, not a Calvinist, married them, they both seemed more surprised than happy. Yet they were happy. And for the first time since she left Earth, she felt whole, at peace, at home. That's why the baby grew within her. The wandering was over, and she was so grateful to Ender that he had understood this, that without their having to discuss it, he had realized that Trondheim was the end of their 3,000-mile odyssey, the end of Demosthenes' career. Like the Ishaksa, she had found a way to root in the ice of this world and draw nourishment that the soil of other lands had not provided. The baby kicked hard, taking her from her reverie. She looked around to see Ender coming toward her, walking along the wharf with his duffel slung over his shoulder. She understood at once why he had brought his bag. He meant to go along on the Sundring. She wondered whether she was glad of it. Ender was quiet and unobtrusive, but he could not possibly conceal his brilliant understanding of human nature. The average students would overlook him, but the best of them, the ones she hoped would come up with original thought, would inevitably follow the subtle but powerful clues he would inevitably drop. The result would be impressive, she was sure. After all, she owed a great debt to his insights over the years. But it would be Ender's brilliance, not the student's. It would defeat somewhat the purpose of the Sondring. But she wouldn't tell him no when he asked to come. Truth to tell, she would love to have him along. Much as she loved Jacht, she missed the constant closeness that she and Ender used to have before she married. It would be years before she and Jacht could possibly be as tightly bound together as she and her brother were. Jacht knew it, too, and it caused him some pain. A husband shouldn't have to compete with his brother-in-law for the devotion of his wife. "Ho, Val," said Ender. "Ho, Ender." Alone on the dock, where no one else could hear, she was free to call him by the childhood name, ignoring the fact that the rest of humanity had turned it into an epithet. "What'll you do if the rabbit decides to bounce out during the Sondring?" She smiled. "Her papa would wrap her in a skrika skin. I would sing her silly Nordic songs, and the students would suddenly have great insights about the impact of reproductive imperatives on history." They laughed together for a moment. And suddenly Valentine knew, without noticing why she knew, that Ender did not want to go on the Sondring, that he had packed his bag to leave Trondheim, and that he had come not to invite her along, but to say goodbye. Tears came unbidden to her eyes, and a terrible devastation wrenched at her. He reached out and held her, as he had so many times in the past. This time, though, her belly was between them, and the embrace was awkward and tentative. "I thought you meant to stay," she whispered. "You turned down the calls that came." "One came that I couldn't turn down." "I can have this baby on Sondring, but not on another world." As she guessed, Ender hadn't meant her to come. "The baby's going to be shockingly blonde," said Ender. "She'd look hopelessly out of place on Lusitania. Mostly black Brazilians there."
So, it would be Lusitania. Valentine understood at once why he was going. The piggy's murder of the xenologer was public knowledge now, having been broadcast during the supper hour in Reykjavik. "You're out of your mind."
"Not really."
"Do you know what would happen if people realized that the Ender is going to the piggy's world? They'd crucify you."
"Well, they'd crucify me here, actually, except that no one but you knows who I am. Promise not to tell."
"What good can you do there? He'll have been dead for decades before you arrive."
"My subjects are usually quite cold before I arrive to speak for them. It's the main disadvantage of being itinerant."
"I never thought to lose you again."
But I knew we had lost each other on the day you first loved Yacht.
Then you should have told me. I wouldn't have done it.
That's why I didn't tell you. But it isn't true, Val. You would have done it anyway. And I wanted you to. You've never been happier.
He put his hands astride her waist. The Wigan jeans were crying out for continuation.
I hope you have a dozen more.
It's considered impolite to have more than four, greedy to go past five, and barbaric to have more than six. Even though she joked, she was deciding how best to handle the sundering. Let the graduate assistants take it without her, cancel it altogether, or postpone it until Ender left. But Ender made the question moot.
Do you think your husband would let one of his boats take me out to the Mareld overnight so I can shuttle to my starship in the morning?
His haste was cruel. If you hadn't needed a ship from Yacht, would you have left me a note on the computer?
I made the decision 5 minutes ago and came straight to you.
But you already booked passage. That takes planning.
Not if you buy the starship.
Why are you in such a hurry? The voyage takes decades.
22 years.
22 years? What difference would a couple of days make? Couldn't you wait a month to see my baby born?
In a month, Val, I might not have the courage to leave you.
Then don't. What are the piggies to you? The buggers are ramen enough for one man's life. Stay. Marry as I've married. You opened the stars to colonization, Ender. Now stay here and taste the good fruits of your labor.
You have Yacht. I have obnoxious students who keep trying to convert me to Calvinism. My labor isn't done yet, and Trondheim isn't my home.
Valentine felt his words like an accusation.
You rooted yourself here without thought of whether I could live in this soil.
But it's not my fault, she wanted to answer. You're the one who's leaving, not me.
Remember how it was, she said, when we left Peter on Earth and took a decades-long voyage to our first colony, to the world you governed?
It was as if he had died. By the time we got there, he was old, and we were still young. When we talked by Ansible, he had become an ancient uncle. The power-ripened hegemon, the legendary Locke, anyone but our brother.
It was an improvement, as I recall. Ender was trying to make things lighter, but Valentine took his words perversely.
Do you think I'll improve, too, in 20 years?
I think I'll grieve for you more than if you had died.
No, Ender, it will be exactly as if I died. And you'll know that you're the one who killed me.
He winced. You don't mean that.
I won't write to you. Why should I? To you, it'll only be a week or two. You'd arrive on Lusitania, and the computer would have 20 years of letters for you from a person you left only the week before. The first 5 years would be grief. The pain of losing you. The loneliness of not having you to talk to.
Yacht is your husband, not me.
And then what would I write? Clever, newsy little letters about the baby? She'd be 5 years old, 6, 10, 20, and married, and you wouldn't even know her, wouldn't even care.
I'll care.
You won't have a chance. I won't write to you until I'm very old, Ender. Until you've gone to Lusitania and then to another place, swallowing the decades in vast gulps. Then I'll send you my memoir. I'll dedicate it to you, to Andrew, my beloved brother. I followed you gladly to 2 dozen worlds, but you wouldn't stay even 2 weeks when I asked you.
Listen to yourself, Val, and then see why I have to leave now before you tear me to pieces.
That's a sophistry you wouldn't tolerate in your students, Ender. I wouldn't have said these things if you weren't leaving like a burglar who was caught in the act. Don't turn the cause around and blame it on me.
He answered breathlessly, his words tumbling over each other in his hurry.
He was racing to finish his speech before emotion stopped him.
No, you're right. I wanted to hurry because I have a work to do there, and every day here is marking time, and because it hurts me every time I see you and Yacht growing closer, and you and me growing more distant,
even though I know that it's exactly as it should be. So when I decided to go, I thought that going quickly was better, and I was right. You know I'm right. I never thought you'd hate me for it. Now emotion stopped him, and he wept. So did she. I don't hate you. I love you. You're part of myself. You're my heart. And when you go, it's my heart torn out and carried away. And that was the end of speech. Rav's first mate took Ender out to the Mareld, the great platform on the equatorial sea, where shuttles were launched into space to rendezvous with orbiting starships. They agreed silently that Valentine wouldn't go with him. Instead, she went home with her husband and clung to him through the night. The next day, she went on sundering with her students and cried for Ender only in darkness, when she thought no one could see. But her students saw, and the story circulated about Professor Wiggins' great grief for the departure of her brother, the itinerant speaker. They made of this what students always do, both more and less than reality. But one student, a girl named Pleekt, became obsessed with the idea that there was more to the story of Valentine and Andrew Wigan than anyone had guessed. So she began to try to research their story, to trace backward their voyages together among the stars. When Valentine's daughter Sifta was 4 years old and her son Ren was 2, Pleekt came to her. She was a young professor at the university by then, and she showed Valentine her published story. She had cast it as fiction, but Valentine recognized at once the story of the brother and sister who were the oldest people in the universe, born on Earth before any colonies had been planted on other worlds, and who then wandered from world to world, rootless, searching. To Valentine's relief, and strangely disappointment, Pleekt had not uncovered the fact that Ender was the original speaker for the dead, and Valentine was Demosthenes. But she knew enough of their story to write the tale of their goodbye when she decided to stay with her husband, and he to go on. The scene was much tenderer and more affecting than it had really been. Pleekt had written what should have happened, if Ender and Valentine had had more sense of theater. "Why did you write this?" Valentine asked her. "Isn't it good enough to be its own reason for writing?" The twisted answer amused Valentine, but it did not put her off. "What was my brother Andrew to you that you've done the research to create this?" "That's still the wrong question," said Pleekt. "I seem to be failing some kind of test. Can you give me a hint what question I should ask?" "Oh, don't be angry. You should be asking me why I wrote it as fiction instead of biography." "Why, then?" "Because I discovered that Andrew Wigan, speaker for the dead, is Ender Wigan, the Xenocide." Even though Ender was 4 years gone, he was still 18 years from his destination. Valentine felt sick with dread, thinking of what his life would be like if he was welcomed on Lusitania as the most loathed man in human history. "You don't need to be afraid, Professor Wigan. If I meant to tell, I could have. When I found it out, I realized that he had repented what he did, and such a magnificent penance. It was the original speaker for the dead who revealed his act as an unspeakable crime. And so he took the role of speaker, like so many hundreds of others, and acted out the role of his own accuser on 20 worlds. "You have found so much, Pleekt, and understood so little."
"I understand everything. Read what I wrote. That was understanding."
Valentine told herself that since Pleekt knew so much, she might as well know more. But it was rage, not reason, that drove Valentine to tell what she had never told anyone before. "Pleekt, my brother didn't imitate the original speaker for the dead. He wrote The Hive Queen and the Hegemon."
When Pleaked realized that Valentine was telling the truth, it overwhelmed her. For all these years, she had regarded Andrew Wiggin as her subject matter, and the original Speaker for the Dead as her inspiration. To find out that they were the same person struck her dumb for half an hour. Then she and Valentine talked and confided and came to trust each other until Valentine invited Plick to be the tutor of her children and her collaborator in writing and teaching. Jacht was surprised at the new addition to the household, but in time Valentine told him the secrets Plick had uncovered through research or provoked out of her. It became the family legend, and as soon as the children were old enough to be discreet, they were told the marvelous stories of their long-lost Uncle Ender, who was thought in every world to be a monster, but in reality was something of a savior, or a prophet, or at least a martyr. The years passed, the family prospered, and Valentine's pain at Ender's loss became pride in him, and finally a powerful anticipation. She was eager for him to arrive on Lusitania, to solve the dilemma of the piggies, to fulfill his apparent destiny as the apostle to the Ramen. It was Plicht, the good Lutheran, who taught Valentine to conceive of Ender's life in religious terms. The powerful stability of her family life and the miracle of each of her five children combined to instill in her the emotions, if not the doctrines, of faith. It was bound to affect the children, too. The tale of Uncle Ender, because they could never mention it to outsiders, took on supernatural overtones. Sifta, the eldest daughter, was particularly intrigued, and even when she turned 20 and rationality overpowered the primitive childish adoration of Uncle Ender, she was still obsessed with him. He was a creature out of legend, and yet he still lived, and on a world not impossibly far away. She did not tell her mother and father, but she did confide in her former tutor. "Someday, Plicht, I'll meet him. I'll meet him and help him in his work." "What makes you think he'll need help? Your help, anyway." Plicht was always a skeptic until her student had earned her belief. "He didn't do it alone the first time, either, did he?" And Sifta's dreams turned outward, away from the ice of Trondheim, to the distant planet where Ender Wiggin had not yet set foot. "People of Lusitania, you little know what a great man will walk on your earth and take up your burden, and I will join him in due time, even though it will be a generation late. Be ready for me too, Lusitania."
On his starship, Ender Wiggin had no notion of the freight of other people's dreams he carried with him. It had been only days since he left Valentine weeping on the dock. To him, Sifta had no name. She was a swelling in Valentine's belly, and nothing more. He was only beginning to feel the pain of losing Valentine, a pain she had long since got over. And his thoughts were far from his unknown nieces and nephews on a world of ice. It was a lonely, tortured young girl named Novinia that he thought of, wondering what the 22 years of his voyage were doing to her, and whom she would have become by the time they met. For he loved her, as you can only love someone who is an echo of yourself at your time of deepest sorrow.